I next met with Dr. Robert Morgan, and he began by commenting on the ASCO plenary presentation commented on by Dr. Penson on early versus delayed systemic therapy of patients with CA125-only recurrence.
This is one of the most important studies that has been presented at ASCO in the last 10 years in GYN oncology. I think the question of CA125 elevation and when someone should be treated because of CA125 elevation has been one of the major questions and controversies in ovarian cancer medicine. For a long time, I think that a lot of people have recognized that the elevation of CA125 does not necessarily indicate that one must initially be treated with chemotherapy, particularly in a patient who's asymptomatic and particularly in a patient who has no radiographic CT evidence of the cancer. However, it does cause anxiety in women, and many patients demand treatment based on their CA125 elevations, based, I think, on the belief that early diagnosis and treatment is always, in every situation, better than waiting and observing cancer growth. The problem there, of course, is that ovarian cancer treatments tend to be somewhat toxic, particularly cytotoxic chemotherapy, and therefore the doctor who knows what's going on with the chemotherapy and what to expect with side effects is sitting there with their patient, and they're trying to weigh the benefits versus the risks of the chemotherapy, and we never really had solid data to tell us that the simple elevation of CA125 was not a good indicator for initial treatment. And so therefore, patients would have to be counseled and many times would say, yes, I want to be as aggressive as possible and wanted early chemotherapy. The study from the UK was a very, very important study, primarily because it took women and randomized patients in a double-blind fashion between getting treatment early based on their CA125 elevation and deferring treatment until clinical symptoms occurred. And patients who had the elevation, and the elevation was defined as a 2-time increase in CA125 above normal, those patients would initially start treatment. The one problem I had with their presentation is they didn't talk about whether any hormonal therapies were included in any of the treatments. So I'm going to be interested in seeing the full publication, because I think that they stepped in with cytotoxic chemotherapy as the treatment approach, whereas many times I think in the United States, if a CA125 is elevated and a woman wants treatment, we will often try tamoxifen or another hormonal therapy early on, because I think the toxicity profile tends to be lower with hormonal therapies than with chemotherapy.
Incidentally, do we know sort of what the rate is of response in terms of using tamoxifen in this situation?
The GOG trial showed a 17% absolute response rate, and then there have been some other trials that have had around a 20% response rate. Aromatase inhibitors, a couple of years ago at ASCO, exemestane was reported to have about a 43% stable disease rate or clinical benefit rate.
And what about estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor measurements and correlations?
There's controversy about that, and they don't seem to necessarily correspond to response with hormonal agents.
The thing, and I guess bottom line, is this study that was reported showed no difference.
It showed absolutely no difference in survival.
And what else, if anything, has been presented at this meeting that you think docs in practice need to know about?
There was another paper that is looking at liposomal doxorubicin as a substitute, I guess, for paclitaxel. It seems to show an improvement in progression-free survival in patients with ovarian cancer in the liposomal doxorubicin arm, but I think we will have to wait until there's survival data published before we can think that that combination, at least except in selected individuals, for example, those patients who may have a pre-existing peripheral neuropathy or, for example, diabetes who are predisposed to peripheral neuropathy, should have a substitution of that, of a carboplatin liposomal doxorubicin regimen instead of a carboplatin paclitaxel regimen.
What's your experience with liposomal doxorubicin? I kind of wondered about why it hasn't moved up earlier, actually. Has it been looked at much earlier?
In the upfront setting,
mm-hmm.
The major trial that was looked at was the 5-arm GOG trial, which was published last year, which randomized the combination of paclitaxel carboplatin versus 4 investigational arms, which included various schedules of gemcitabine inclusions, liposomal doxorubicin inclusions. And what it showed on that five-arm trial was that all five combinations had identical survival curves with differing toxicity profiles depending on what the combination was. And so the conclusion of the trial was that paclitaxel carboplatin remained the backbone of standard chemotherapy for ovarian cancer. However, I think that the other conclusion that can be drawn is that the other combinations could potentially be used for various reasons depending on an individual patient, although many of them had more complications and more toxicity than the paclitaxel carboplatin control arm.
Although, I mean, the reports we hear on the agent, maybe in more experienced hands, is pretty well tolerated. Is that your experience?
Liposomal doxorubicin? Mm-hmm. I use liposomal doxorubicin quite frequently for ovarian cancer for several reasons. Number one, I use it because it only has to be administered every 3 to 4 weeks, and the other second-line therapies are generally administered weekly. The second reason is because the toxicity profile is quite tolerable. Usually, patients may have some hand-foot syndrome. There's very little hematologic toxicity. There can be sometimes some mucositis, and there's not too much nausea and vomiting. The other thing patients like is they don't lose their hair from the liposomal doxorubicin. So I use it fairly frequently, although I don't use it at the 50 milligram per meter squared dosage. I think most people are dropping the initial dosage to 40 milligrams per meter squared because of the cutaneous toxicity. The dosage then can be raised if patients tolerate it.
Okay, well, why don't we shift over to your cases? And somewhere along the line, I'd like to get your take also and your experience with the NCCN guidelines process and you know, how that evolves. But let's talk about your patients first, though. Maybe we can start out with this 81-year-old woman. I always like hearing about people over age 80 because that's where you get the questions, I think, in terms of clinical practice as opposed to, you know, 65 or 70. So what happened with this lady?
Well, this lady initially came to us back in 2002, and she was only 74 at that time. And she initially had a change in bowel habits and presented actually to her local emergency room with a bowel obstruction. And she required surgery and a colonic resection and was found to have peritoneal carcinomatosis from a papillary serous ovarian cancer. Following her initial surgery, she came to our institution for an opinion. And our opinion was that she should have a completion surgery by a gynecologic oncologist. And it has been shown that for malarian malignancies, a gynecologic oncologist intervention does result in improved outcomes compared to non-gynecologic oncologists doing the surgery.
And this is not an unusual story either, I guess, huh?
No, often this happens because patients will go to their doctor. They will require treatment for their acute symptoms. However, then one must decide what to do best for their ovarian cancer. So my patient was seen by our gynecologic oncologist and then was taken back to an attempt at an optimal debulking procedure. However, unfortunately, she had such bulky disease at that time, even on the treatment, that she was suboptimally debulked, which means that the tumor nodules remaining inside the abdomen were greater than 1 centimeter. So I think the important thing about ovarian cancer patients is if we can enroll patients on clinical trials, we're going to learn more and more about the best ways to treat this illness. And so consequently, at the time, the Southwest Oncology Group was coordinating a study that was looking at neoadjuvant chemotherapy in suboptimally debulked patients, followed by an interval debulking procedure, followed by a combination of intravenous and intraperitoneal chemotherapy, which was similar but not identical to the Armstrong regimen. So our patient was presented with this study, and she was interested in participating, and consequently, she enrolled in the Southwest Oncology Group study. At that time, it was 0009, and she received 3 cycles of carboplatin and paclitaxel as neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and about 3 months later then went back to an interval debulking surgery, and at that time was optimally cytoreduced.
Pretty aggressive therapy for a woman in her mid-70s, but I guess she got through it okay.
This lady did great. Dr. David Ettinger from Johns Hopkins.
One of my favorites.
Dr. Ettinger says that his goal in life is to treat someone with chemotherapy who's more than 100 years old.
I think I actually have him on audio saying
that. Is that right? But this patient did very well. She tolerated the chemotherapy extremely well. She had the usual side effects of nausea and vomiting and some abdominal distension, but in general, tolerated the chemotherapy well. The intravenous and intraperitoneal arm of the Southwest Oncology Group study involved intravenous paclitaxel, intraperitoneal carboplatin, and intraperitoneal paclitaxel on day 8. So she had her chemotherapy and did well and was basically without evidence of disease by the time she completed the chemotherapy cycles.
So can you bring us up to date in terms of where she is?
Well, this is a long story because she had about approximately a 1 year remission from her cancer. And at that time, she had a biochemical CA125 elevation, but also a CT scan recurrence. And at that time, she was considered platinum sensitive and therefore was treated again with a platinum taxane regimen. But she had a little bit of persistent neuropathy, so she was treated with docetaxel as the second taxane at that time, and again had a complete response. And then had a little bit more than a year's remission. And at that time, I had offered her a clinical trial, but because she had done well with the previous treatment, she preferred to have chemotherapy again with the same regimen. And she had a partial response after 6 cycles of carboplatin docetaxel. And about 5 months later, following 6 cycles of chemotherapy, she was placed on tamoxifen because she had some residual disease. And she again had about a 6-month progression-free interval. And at that time, had progression with liver metastases and was treated on an in-house investigator-initiated trial that's ongoing at City of Hope, almost completed accrual at this point, of metronomic cyclophosphamide with or without celecoxib. Both of those agents in those schedules and doses have some anti-angiogenic activity, which is the thesis for our trial. She was randomized
daily cyclophosphamide.
Daily low-dose metronomic cyclophosphamide, yes. And she turned out to get a severe erythematous reaction to the celecoxib. We stopped the celecoxib, the rash all went away, and she continued on the cyclophosphamide for about 2.5 years and remained in remission until early January of this year when she progressed again. And subsequent to that, we've now been treating her with carboplatin and pemetrexed, which was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology as an excellent regimen. And she is currently responding to that combination at this point, although she's having more side effects, I think, at age 81 than she had at age 74.
So as you look back on this long history and your gut feeling, do you think this is really the biology of the disease or the treatment you've been giving or sort of a combination?
Well, I know it's a combination. The ovarian cancer tends to be a disease which responds to repeated recurrence therapies. Unfortunately, the remissions tend to become shorter, particularly in the platinum-retreated patients, so that a remission a second or third time following retreatment with platinum tend to be progressively shorter. However, this lady has had clear progressive disease, and when she's had progressive disease, she's also had abdominal symptoms. So this wouldn't be the patient that was in the study that was published yesterday who's had a CA125 alone elevation. This patient instead was those patients that would be in that group of patients who had been excluded because she relapsed clinically at the same time as her CA125 had elevated. And every time we treated her, her symptoms went away. And so for almost 2.5 years on a mild regimen of treatment, she actually had a normal quality of life.
Yeah, that's the one thing that does sort of jump out in her history, that 2.5 years on the cyclophosphamide. And I mean, do you think, I mean, people have talked about metronomic therapy as being anti-angiogenic. Do you think that's the case?
I'm not sure whether it's a combination of anti-angiogenic properties. Clearly, they have anti-angiogenic properties. However, I'm not sure if it's just that or whether it's a continuous cytotoxic effect or cytostatic effect of the alkylator agent. Although she did not have any hematologic toxicity, and I think you would expect if it was primarily an alkylating agent effect that you should have seen some effect on the bone marrow also.
Yeah, because, I mean, I don't know whether you're thinking at some point in the future to maybe consider anti— I mean, I don't know, do you use bevacizumab off study right now in ovarian cancer?
I have used it, but I use it moderately rarely.
So, you know, because actually when you were mentioning that, I was thinking about in breast cancer, they actually reported a phase 2 study with pretty interesting results looking at metronomic cyclophosphamide method trexate with bevacizumab. Have there been an interest in combining anti-angiogenic agents with metronomic therapy in ovarian cancer?
Well, actually, there was a paper published, Dr. Augustine Garcia, who is with the California Cancer Consortium, with which we also participate at City of Hope, published a paper looking at metronomic oral daily cyclophosphamide with bevacizumab, and it showed a substantial response rate. I think the response rate, well, I can't tell you, I haven't yet looked at all of the data from our in-house trial, but the response rate was substantial with the combination.
So what about this 57-year-old lady? She looks interesting.
This lady was a very nice lady who again presented to her doctor with diffuse carcinomatosis. But one of her major problems was she had recurrent, clinically symptomatic, very symptomatic ascites formation as part of her treatment course.
And she presented that way.
She presented that way.
How often does that happen?
Distension. It actually happens very frequently in ovarian cancer. 70 to 80% of patients probably present to their physicians with abdominal distension as their initial course, and at least half of those are probably due to ascites formation.
How often are those people able to be optimally debulked with ascites like that?
Well, I think that in the United States, at least 60 or 70% of patients by trained, excellent, aggressive gynecologic oncologists can be optimally debulked.
So what happened with this lady?
So this lady, again, was treated initially. She required a laparoscopy for her diagnosis and then came to our institution where about a week later she underwent a laparotomy. Again, unfortunately, this lady was suboptimally debulked based on the bulky tumor nodules, primarily in the pelvis. And again, she was treated with neoadjuvant chemotherapy. At that time, the Southwest Oncology Group study had completed accrual, and we did not have an open study for her at the time. She received neoadjuvant chemotherapy, to which she responded. She was treated again with interval debulking about 4 months later, and then was treated with postoperative intraperitoneal chemotherapy, much like the Southwest Oncology Group study, and had a complete response. However, unfortunately, her complete response lasted only about 6 months. And she presented with increasing adenopathy. She had back pain as well as a very mild elevation of CA125. It actually was not above normal limits, but it had increased to the mid-20s. However, because of the symptoms she required, she had a CT scan and had adenopathy on the scan. And at that time, she was then treated again on a phase 2 trial of AZD2171, which subsequently has received a name. It's called Sidirinib now, and two studies were published last year at ASCO showing a major response with this agent, which is an oral anti-angiogenic agent.
So it's a TKI that's against VEGF?
Yes.
And how did she tolerate it?
Well, she had substantial side effects to the drug that required a substantial amount of intervention. Her primary problem was diarrhea, although this lady had had diarrhea previous to her illness, so bowel symptoms were a pre-existing complaint. However, they became substantially worse with the AZD2171, including nocturnal stools 7 or 8 per evening. So we initially tried the usual bowel motility medications. That didn't work, but we then put her on sandostatin, which controlled her diarrhea very, very well. In fact, about a month and a half after, or 2 months after she went on the sandostatin, she decided, and her sister decided, they wanted to go on a cruise to Europe. And she was doing so well, I said, go.
But she had a useful response to this agent.
She then, about 6 months after she was started on this agent, basically her ascites completely resolved, adenopathy completely resolved, and she then had a CT scan, which was read by a radiologist as no evidence of disease. Now, the problem at that point was is that a CT scan also showed an embolus sitting in her pulmonary artery. Hmm. And so at that point, I was concerned because of the concern regarding clotting or bleeding with anti-angiogenic agents, and I took her off the AZD2171 at that time empirically because I was concerned about the thrombogenic effects. And 2 months later, the CT scan showed that the clot had completely resolved on anticoagulants, although, and she remained in complete response. Hmm. So I did not restart anything at that time since she was asymptomatic and the scan showed no evidence of disease.
Where's this agent heading? I mean, it sounds like there's some promise there.
I think that based on the two studies that were published last year at ASCO showing a very substantial response rate, that I would be surprised if this agent didn't receive an indication at some point in the near future, at least in ovarian cancer.
What's your experience? I don't know how many people you've treated with this, but what's your experience in terms of side effects and toxicity?
That's the major problem, is that it does have substantial amount of side effects, primarily the usual side effects of this class of agents, which is hypertension and bowel symptoms, diarrhea. But I think they're controllable. I know that this agent hasn't shown as good of response rates in some other type of tumors that have been treated on phase two trials, but in ovarian cancer, I'm quite pleased with the results that I've seen.
And I guess it's not a total shock given the fact that bevacizumab and other anti-angiogenic agents seems to have pretty significant activity.
Well, bevacizumab seems to be a better agent in ovarian cancer than in many of the other malignancies, and ovarian cancer has a higher single agent response rate than in any other tumor in which it's been tested.
This patient really benefited, I guess, from being involved with a clinical trial.
Well, this patient benefited a tremendous amount. Again, her quality of life markedly improved once we were able to control her diarrhea. And then, unfortunately, her cancer recurred again.
So how long did she go? You know, doing pretty well off
She
therapy.
Had about a six-month off-treatment, completely off-treatment remission, and then recurred again with recurrent ascites. Now, this may have been a little controversial as to what to do next, but because she had such an excellent response to an anti-angiogenic agent and she remained on anticoagulation, I elected to treat her with bevacizumab at that point, particularly given that her ascites was the main symptomatic problem for her.
And I've been hearing ever since I started working with ovarian investigators this story about maybe bevacizumab having actually an anti-ascitic effect in addition to an anti-tumor effect.
Yeah, bevacizumab has excellent ascites control. Now, the other thing, there was an article published, I haven't seen the full publication yet, out of Johns Hopkins about 3 years ago in the supportive care portion looking at intraperitoneal bevacizumab, which showed that it was very, very effective as a control of ascites administered intraperitoneally.
Wow, intraperitoneal.
It had a very, very high ascites control rate.
Interesting.
Intraperitoneally.
So what happened with this lady?
So this lady had another response, and her CA-125 went down. Her ascites was again controlled. She again got diarrhea, requiring sandostatin readministration, and had about a six-month remission on bevacizumab.
And her ascites was tumor ascites. There were cells.
It was tumor ascites.
Do you ever see transudates that are, you know, related to adenopathy or something else?
I think that's pretty rare. It can occur a few times, but the majority of the time, these are malignant ascites issues.
Any problems with the bevacizumab?
The only problem she had, again, was the diarrhea.
Hypertension, no problem?
I believe she probably had a little bit of hypertension, too, but we had her on some antihypertensive medications.
Right. Nosebleeds?
No, I had no bleeding problems.
We hear a lot about nosebleeds with bevacizumab and the solid tumors. Not like that it's a major problem usually, but very frequent. I mean, that's what people tell us.
Yeah, I've not seen that in ovarian cancer patients.
Interesting. Anyhow, so she had a good response, and then what?
And then, unfortunately, she recurred, and we attempted some treatment with carboplatin and pemetrexed again. However, this patient's cancer did become refractory, and ultimately she expired from progression of her cancer a couple of months later. However, during the entire time, she basically had about 3 years, and even during all of her treatment, I think her quality of life was acceptable, and in fact, again, her sister wanted to take her on a cruise, and she, while on an investigational agent, was able to do that and had a very, very good, I think, life during that time. And at the end of the treatment, the cancer, unfortunately, had increasing, at least severe symptoms.
I think the course of this lady also kind of ties in with, you know, a major trend that's going on, which is to look at anti-angiogenesis. In ovarian cancer, as you say, there's a lot of encouraging things with bevacizumab. What about bringing bevacizumab in earlier?
In ovarian cancer. Mm-hmm. Right now, the gynecologic oncology group's primary treatment is trying to do that. And the randomized trial in stage 3 and stage 4 ovarian cancer is carboplatin paclitaxel with or without bevacizumab. And that trial is supposed to complete accrual, I think, by the end of this year.
I wonder what you all think now one day after the adjuvant bevacizumab colon study has been presented. I think the first adjuvant trial looking at anti-angiogenesis at the Norm Wallmark presented with, you know, really interesting results in that while the bevacizumab was on board, there was a 40% reduction in recurrence. And then after that time, a year, when they stop it, recurrence rates come together. What were your thoughts about it? And how do you think the ovarian investigators are going to be thinking about that as it relates? Of course, it's a different disease, et cetera. But what did you think about that?
Well, I think that the data for colon cancer were unfortunately disappointing. I'm not sure that it's going to be practical to do some of the recommendations, which is to give bevacizumab for, you know, if you do it for 2 years and then we find out the same type of curves that come together, whether then we're going to give it for 3 years or indefinitely with its toxicity profile. I don't believe, plus the cost factors, that that's going to be a practical approach. But I think the issue has to do in ovarian cancer, whether particularly since in the upfront setting, we are trying to cure ovarian cancer. We're trying to get patients at least into a prolonged remission. And the drug has clearly been shown, I think, to show a synergistic effect with cytotoxic chemotherapy. So I don't know whether we're going to see an improvement or whether we're going to see those curves come together the same as we're seeing with the colon cancer patients. I think that potentially we could see the same type of an effect as we saw with colon cancer. But I think that there's one other issue that's involved here, and that's the constant squabble between intraperitoneal chemotherapy and intravenous chemotherapy in ovarian cancer.
Yep.
And I'm an intraperitoneal advocate based on the published data. I think that the finding of an 18-month improvement in survival on the Armstrong trial that was published in New England Journal of Medicine a couple of years ago is quite compelling. And so I think that you have these two issues. There are some investigators who feel that the addition of bevacizumab will result in somewhat the same type of findings as we found with the addition of intraperitoneal chemotherapy. I don't believe that, frankly, because I think that particularly in all the other cancers, and then given the data from yesterday, we've seen an improvement of a couple of months potentially in other cancers, and I do not see that bevacizumab is going to add 18 months to the results of intravenous chemotherapy. So I think that that's the other fly in the ointment, as it were, for ovarian cancer as to what the role of intraperitoneal chemotherapy is going to be and whether we can generate a regimen of intraperitoneal chemotherapy that's going to be more tolerable and more accepting by the physicians.
People talk about ovarian cancer being, quote, more bloody or, you know, what do we know about the biology of ovarian cancer in terms of why it may or may not be more susceptible to this kind of therapy?
Well, VEGF levels are very high in ovarian cancer, and that's true in the ascites fluid also, which may be one of the reasons why intraperitoneal bevacizumab was effective in ascites control. So we know that it's a potentially excellent target just from preclinical data. That correlation, however, has not yet been shown.
What about the issue of intraperitoneal therapy in terms of what's going on in clinical practice? My sense is that not too many docs in community-based practice are doing this.
The problem with intraperitoneal chemotherapy is that the major regimen that had been shown to have a benefit was the Armstrong regimen, which involves very dose-aggressive and dose-intensive cisplatin. And cisplatin is about the hardest drug, I think, in my opinion, as an oncologist that we have to administer. And so consequently, because of the severe toxicity, primarily nausea, vomiting, myelosuppression, and neuropathy that were shown, doctors have been unable to accept it. Now, in my opinion, intraperitoneal chemotherapy needs to be administered somewhere where the physicians, and probably even more importantly, the nurses, are familiar with the administration of the drug. And if a institution is not familiar, or the nursing staff isn't familiar, they probably shouldn't be doing it because there are more complications. It is more difficult. It does take some specialized databases and knowledge bases in order to effectively administer it safely.
You know, our group is always interested in trying to study what's going on in practice, and we've done that now in a bunch of tumors, but we haven't done it in ovarian cancer. I really wonder what's going on out there, and particularly whether patients are being offered referral to a center that does intraperitoneal therapy or not.
I suspect that most patients are not. The vast majority of patients are being offered intravenous chemotherapy, which I think is a reasonable alternative. In my opinion, however, the data suggests that intraperitoneal chemotherapy is superior in terms of long-term outcomes.
What about age and intraperitoneal therapy? Is there sort of an upper limit? I mean, of course, you're going to look at performance status and comorbidities, but is there an age where you just stop doing it?
No. The first patient that we discussed this morning
was
in her early to mid-70s, and she tolerated it fine. And I've treated a number of patients in their 70s who tolerate intraperitoneal chemotherapy well. It's a matter of the nursing staff being familiar with how to administer the agents, as well as the appropriate supportive care medications that are administered along with them.
What do you say to patients in counseling them or trying to make this decision about what to expect with side effects and toxicity, intraperitoneal versus intravenous?
Yeah. I have to warn them that the intraperitoneal chemotherapy is much more intensive and it involves a lot more investment in time and effort by the patient. And the major reason for that is that in my experience, I have not had good luck trying to treat with the initial day one, day two chemotherapy on the Armstrong regimen as an outpatient. So I've admitted the patients for control of symptoms, for good hydration because of the high-dose cisplatin. And subsequently, my nurse practitioner, as we got more experience with the Armstrong regimen, discovered that patients would have delayed toxicity, which we knew from the cisplatin, but patients are much more able to tolerate it if we send them home and actually have home health or have them come back into the clinic daily for about a week after their chemotherapy for intravenous hydration. And the more I've spoken with people who've been using the Armstrong regimen at other institutions, everyone is somewhat become aware of that exact fact. And almost all the patients are going to require daily hydration for at least a week after their initial chemotherapy.
How much hydration do you use?
1 liter to 2 liters, depending on patient size and how much they're able to take down orally.
I mean, it makes total sense.
It certainly does. And it has made a tremendous difference in our patients' tolerance.
That's really interesting. Just to finish out a little bit on the NCCN guidelines process, I'm curious. I always like to talk to Bob Carlson. I've been talking to him for years about the breasting and how they sort of go through all this stuff. As you look back over the last few years, what are some of the major things that you all within the committee have been sort of talking about, debating, and having controversy about?
It's been a very interesting change. I've been involved with the Ovarian Cancer Committee since its inception about 1995, and we're going on 15 years now of annual meetings. And it's been very interesting. Back when we first started, there was quite a bit of controversy about the role of radiation or total abdominal radiation therapy in ovarian cancer, and there were a couple of institutions that insisted that that be placed as a potential treatment approach for advanced ovarian cancer. And over the years, I think that radiation therapy has more and more fallen out of favor, and right now it's not mentioned in the NCCN guidelines except as a potential palliative measure for patients. At the same time, we had very, very marked discussions about the role of intraperitoneal chemotherapy when we first started. In fact, in the initial days of the NCCN guidelines, intraperitoneal chemotherapy was considered a Category 3, meaning that there's major disagreement between the institutions as to the role. And some institutions feel that it should be considered an option, other institutions feeling that it's basically malpractice to even do it. And over the years, as more data has been accumulating, initially the Albert study, subsequently the Markman study, and then the Armstrong study, we now consider this a Category 1 recommendation. So intraperitoneal chemotherapy in selected patient populations has gone from marked disagreement to agreement, or at least assent between all the institutions that there's good Category 1 evidence favoring this as an approach. So that's one of the things. The second thing that's gone over the years has been various adjustments in the recommendations regarding the role of interval surgeries and the role of interval debulking surgeries, as well as which patients should be taken back for completion staging procedures if they come to an NCCN institution having had incomplete surgery. And I think over the years, the guideline panel has become more surgically aggressive rather than less surgically aggressive. Of course, the other major change that's occurred since we've started is the number and types and combinations of recurrence therapies available. So I put this information together for another presentation. And when we first started, there were about 9 possible recurrence therapies. And at this point, we've had to take the recurrence therapies and put them in various columns as preferred and non-preferred agents, and then separate them out into cytotoxics versus hormonal therapies versus other types of therapies. So there have been a major improvement in the last 14 years as to potential treatments that are available.
It's really amazing. I remember when the NCCN started, I was like, I don't know about this, guidelines, whatever, but it's just incredible. We know from surveys of oncologists, too, how commonly they consult not just the guidelines, but, you know, those descriptors that you all write, which to me, I think replaced oncology textbooks.
I'm not sure it's replaced them, but it has certainly become one of the major references that people are using. This is true internationally also. The NCCN guidelines have been presented in Japan. I've gone to China to collaborate. They've been presented in Abu Dhabi, of all places.
Amazing.
And so they've become an international reference standard.